We're running late. We're running close on time. We've only got another 15 minutes of our allotted time. Mrs. Lackman, it's your turn. I have the pleasure of introducing Shirley Robin Letwin. Got a PhD at the University of Chicago. She taught at Chicago, Harvard, Brandeis, and the London School of Economics, and now at Cambridge in England. She's the author of many articles in law reviews and other learned journals. The author of a book called Human Freedom and the Pursuit of Certainty, Hume, Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and Beatrice Webb. Now completing a book on Trollope's Gentleman, and we'll then turn to a forthcoming book on the history of the philosophy of law, which is under contract with Allen and Unwin. Mrs. Letwin.
I would like to emphatically support Professor Curlin by disagreeing with him. It's a peculiar sort of disagreement, and in explaining it, I shall spell out some very simple ideas, which I'm sure he knows as well as anyone does. But I think that his manner of arguing against the judicial invasion of the legislative function has obscured these ideas and encouraged precisely what he wants to oppose. And I think if Professor Curlin can create this kind of confusion, others can do much more, and others are doing it quite deliberately. And I'd like to concentrate on the two basic concepts that I think have to be emphasized by anyone who wants to distinguish sharply the judicial function from the legislative one. Now, the first of these concepts is the discretion of the judge. Now, here I think Professor Curlin tends to lead us astray by referring to a very venerable figure, indeed the most conservative of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton. I think that Hamilton's statement that the judiciary ought to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, is dangerously misleading. For we cannot begin to understand why we need judges at all without recognizing that a judge's decision is necessarily an act of will. It cannot be anything else, because the judge's job is to decide what a general rule means in particular circumstances. And that decision cannot be deduced from any law, however simple it is or however clearly framed it is. If such deductions were possible, we could staff the courts with geometricians and we wouldn't need judges. We need the judge to bridge this unavoidable logical gap between a general rule and a concrete decision. Now, this is so elementary that the grown-ups regularly forget it. But that doesn't make it any less fundamental to understanding what a judge ought to be doing under the rule of law. Now, it follows, and I think this has to be emphasized, not played down, that the judge always exercises discretion in all cases whatsoever, even when everyone agrees with his decision. It follows also that every judicial decision must change the law, but that this kind of change is very different from making law. And unless we get that clear, and unless we make that clear to the legal profession and to the public, we invite and we promote the most insidious kind of attacks on the distinction between the judge and the legislator. I think the kind of attack that's now being made regularly and very effectively by that great defender of liberty, Ronald Dworkin, is typical. Dworkin's export from Yale to Oxford is one of the best things that has happened lately to America. Dworkin's argument, which is always neatly disguised, runs as follows. I'm a very fervent defender of the rule of law because I'm second to no man in believing that in clear cases the judge must uphold the law. But in ambiguous cases, every moral man would surely agree that a nice, decent judge would decide in a moral way. That is, he would promote progressive policies. Now, as no case is clear, in the sense that Dworkin is so happy to recognize, it follows that we're all obliged to conclude that judges must always promote progressive policies. Now, it's a little disconcerting to find this line of argument in Professor Carlin's discussion. He did, I'm afraid, speak occasionally as if in some cases there could be perfectly automatic or clear decisions. And it's not surprising that he went on to say, rather as Dworkin does, that we should not chastise judges when in an ambiguous situation their personal values are necessarily involved. If the separation of judging from legislating is defended in this way, those who want to fuse them have some very effective friends in the very best quarters. The only effective way to defend the distinction between judges and lawmakers is to emphasize, first, that judges always exercise discretion, and secondly, that nevertheless, this is a very different kind of discretion from legislative discretion. We ought to concentrate on making plain what is certainly extremely difficult to do, and that's why the idea has got lost, the kinds of reasons and reasoning that are appropriate to a judge's discretion. And such reasons definitely do not include, as Professor Carlin did say, personal values, apart from one personal value, a determination to do what a judge ought to do while he's sitting on the bench, which excludes his implementing any other personal values. But it's impossible to explain how a judge can exercise discretion and not become a lawmaker without drawing on the concept of authority. That word, however, seems to have been banned by the Philadelphia Society. I did hear it once this morning. Professor Bradford used it for the only time, but he used it metaphorically. There's been a great deal of talk, endless talk, about power, more and less power, greater and stronger and weaker power, and so on. But I haven't noticed any concern about distinguishing between power and authority, which is the essence of the rule of law. If I'd been brought here blindfolded, I would have concluded that I'd fallen into a den of Marxists. Instead of the distinction between the gunman and the policeman, which defenders of liberty might be expected to insist on, we were told the other night that a tax inspector is no different from a thief, and no one objected. Now, a thief imposes a decision that he has not been authorized to make. That means he wields power. And when we yield, we don't feel obliged to obey him. We do, or we ought to feel obliged to obey an officer of the law because he has been authorized to make his decision. Now, I don't know whether Professor Carlin has been corrupted by the Philadelphia Society, but he did tend to speak exclusively about power. When he used authority, as when he said that authority has devolved upon a vast bureaucracy, he meant that the bureaucracy had usurped power. By failing to keep this distinction clear, Professor Carlin introduced arguments for his conclusion that make the opposite case irresistible. He told us that it was unfortunate that the federal judges in Boston had replaced the school boards because judges were not likely to make efficient educational experts. Now, this implies that if judges were more efficient than the professional educational experts at running schools, it would be quite a good thing for judges to replace school boards. Given the character of our current educational experts these days, the most unfortunate symptom, I think, of the failure to distinguish power from authority is the disposition which, again, Professor Carlin displayed to describe all regulations as laws. Now, that's been another commonplace here, which gives the Philadelphia Society a great affinity with the Marxists. Professor Curlin said, we have become overburdened by laws, whether they be statutes, executive orders, regulations, guidelines, or judicial decrees. He talked, as everyone else here has, about laws made by bureaucrats. Now, since we were assured this morning that we're not really very short of duly promulgated laws, it does seem unnecessary to boost the record by including such obvious imposters. Instead of talking about the quantity of laws, I think we ought to be taking a lot of trouble to distinguish real laws from law-like rules, even when they appear in the stuff turned out by Congress. And we certainly ought to be insisting on the fact that regulations, which are ad hoc orders and decrees, are not laws. And if we use law indiscriminately to cover all these fake laws, we're simply encouraging a misunderstanding of what law is about. When Professor Curlin remarked that the judiciary once served as a limiting force on governmental authority, he implied that authority can be made or unmade by force, which is a very good revolutionary argument because it belongs to the notion that government is a matter of power and the rule of law is simply a sham covering up of their power as against our power. The same sort of confusion is encouraged by talking about the Constitution as if it were a defense of rights. The Constitution defines, or ought to, it does define, the authority of different offices of government. The Constitution doesn't protect rights. It defines conditions that must be observed in making, interpreting, and enforcing the law. This talk of rights has made both the United States and England and other countries a battleground in which, of course, the most ruthless people are bound to win. If an official misuses his authority, he breaks the law. If there's a dispute about whether an official has used his authority properly, the issue has to be decided by the courts. Now, the effect of this decision may be to put what Professor Curlin described as a brake on the powers usurped by some branch of the government. But the office of the judiciary is not to act as a brake, a restraint, a limiting force or power. The courts are authorized to interpret the law, and that's what we have to emphasize. Unless we keep that absolutely clear, we will be unwittingly reducing the judiciary to another interest group, another instrument to be used by interest groups while we intend to defend it. I think that the difference between living under a tyranny and a constitutional government is the difference between submitting to power, to the gunman, and recognizing an obligation to obey authorized decisions by authorized officers of the law, even when they are tax inspectors and the tax laws are monstrous. But constitutional government is not likely to flourish if the most clear-headed conservatives forget to distinguish judicial discretion from legislating, if they forget to distinguish between authority and power. I don't think it's enough to advocate the right conclusions, because what will be popular tomorrow will probably depend on the arguments we use to defend what we advocate today rather than the conclusions that we're constantly putting forward.